Each second Saturday of the month, we will play a compilation of excerpts from memorable morning shows that have aired over the previous several weeks. Today's program will include excerpts from a conversation about the Racine Theatre Guild's marvelous production of Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods, as well as an excerpt from the final morning show appearance of outgoing Gateway Technical College president Brian Albrecht. First, we're going to play for you an excerpt from my interview recorded and broadcast early in July with award-winning illustrator Ed Steckley, a Racine native, a proud alum of Washington Park High School, whose career has taken him far and wide. Ed recently returned to Racine to be close to family, and I met Ed because he was cast in the Racine Theatre Guild's production of Mamma Mia. And it was in getting to know Ed that I got to know about his life as a professional illustrator, a career which has included stints with Mad Magazine. In our conversation, we touched on many aspects of Ed's long and eventful career. I want to ask you a little bit about that work that you did in those summers, and actually for many, many years, that live caricature drawing in theme parks. Mm-hmm. And of course, I think probably most of our listeners know what you're talking about, but obviously for those that don't, it's when you go to one of these stands and you sit there and some artist draws a caricature of you that mm-hmm. looks kind of like you, but in sort of cartoonish fashion. What is involved in doing that? I mean, when you are, and I realize you probably haven't done that in quite some time, but when somebody sits down in front of you, a client as you were, as it is, what is it that you're doing in terms of looking at them and fashioning a caricature of them? What's actually involved in that process?
That's a great question, because I like to think that, well, I like to think, I can actually say with certainty that caricature is more psychological than physical drawing. You can take a pen or a marker, we would use big, thick pencils, you can draw something, but you have to reach into the back of your head, and when someone looks at another person, unconsciously we all create this snapshot. It's a first impression. So you can look at someone and then look away, and later on you can look back and kind of remember that person because of this unconscious snapshot that you have in your head. But what a good caricaturist does, and there's, you know, this is, I could talk about, you know, that business, but what a good caricaturist does is able to reach into that unconscious and bring this snapshot forward and realize what stands out, what makes this person different from the next person. Faces only vary in millimeters. If an alien came down from the sky and looked at two different people, we would look the same, no matter who we were, because, you know, eyes vary in millimeters. Noses are basically here. Mouths are only, they only do this. They don't do that, you know. What we would do is really get into the psychology of it and figure and try to deconstruct that person's face. And a lot of that, one of the tricks is to, you know, if someone sits in front of you, what you squint your eyes, you make a dumb face, you squint your eyes until you can barely see anymore, and what's left is what's important about that person. And then you emphasize those. There's a lot of misconception about good caricature. A lot of people think, oh, it's mean, or it's just going to make my nose big. What you do is you're celebrating that person's face, and you can bring to the table whatever you like. A mentor of mine out in New York would say that you can bring to the table, you can look through lenses that are, let's see, what's a better way to put this? You can bring love to the table. You can draw someone and you know, where your head's at, it can be more of a celebration. Or some people like to draw where they go for the jugular and make things mean. I was never that guy. I was always a nice caricature guy. But we took a lot of pride in our work. A lot of us, all of us, had always had copies of Mad close by because that's where the caricatures were. And who we hired were people that were very serious about doing art. So a lot of people from... Especially, it kind of ended in the 90s when the business model changed for theme parks. But we had a lot of people go off to do comic books. The monsters and Stranger Things are designed by a caricature artist who we worked with in St. Louis. So it was, you know, we hired artists who took it very seriously. A few of us went off to do Mad, as an example. Actually, I started in Cracked magazine.
Yeah, I remember
Cracked. A lot of people who went to work for Cracked did it because they wanted to get into Mad, and Mad at least looked at Cracked. There's always a cheap knockoff.
Right.
But, you know, that, but so the theme park stuff absolutely translated into the real world. And it also, when you're sitting there drawing for 12 hours a day and you've got people behind you watching you, commenting, judging, you get a thick skin. And I got that. That helped me immensely, especially working in advertising in New York. You got to work with what I had to do was I'd have to sit in a round table full of art directors and creative directors and muckety-mucks and everybody and sit and draw live. Well, they're looking over your shoulder, you know, making comments. That absolutely doesn't bother me at all. So I can draw whatever, wherever. I don't care who's around. It doesn't matter. I know a lot of artists, I have to be alone. It was never that. It's just, you know, we do work alone a lot. It's a very solitary life, but I never had a problem with drawing live. That said, there's a lot of people in New York especially who like to bring sketchbooks onto the subway. It just sketch people who are there, and I was never that guy. Because then you draw attention to yourself, and I don't want that. But, yeah, I could talk about the correlation between drawing live in the theme parks to how that translates to the real world. If, you know, I could go on and on about that. So you need to stop me.
Award-winning illustrator Ed Steckley. By the way, Ed and I discovered that he had been on the morning show before. Some years earlier, Ed was one of the artists invited to come to Kenosha to be part of the Kenosha Festival of Cartooning, that wonderful event organized and created by John and Ann Morse Hambrock. You're listening to Morning Show Saturday on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Several days after I spoke with Ed Steckley on the morning show, I had the pleasure of welcoming into our studios two men deeply involved in the Racine Theater Guild's production of Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods. Rob Cruz, director of choral and theatrical activities at Union Grove High School, served as both stage and music director of this amazing production. And among those who populated the talented cast, Nick Cicerelli, head of the theater department at Tremper High School in Kenosha, who served in the critical role of the narrator. Rob, how big a cast are we talking about altogether?
We have 20 in the cast total, and we actually had 90 people audition for the production. So you can tell that it was a very popular show. People love this show to come out in that significant way.
Right. That brings back memories of when we did Les Mis. And, you know, of course, going into it, I was just terrified that we wouldn't have who we needed in order to do that. The big guns you just have to have for Les Mis, and people just came from hither and yon. I mean, it was amazing. And there are several shows I can think of where a similar kind of onslaught of talent came through the door hoping to be part of this. And I should think, Rob, you appreciate, as I know Doug does, the fact that this cast is a wonderful mix of some veterans who have been on that stage a lot and some really talented people for whom this is their very first show at the Guild.
Yeah, it really speaks to the lighting up lives at all stages, which is that motto of the Racine Theater Guild. It's wonderful to have those veterans, like you said, come in and mentor and just kind of show the ropes of our personal space, which is different than other theaters. But then it's great to get that new blood in and have this really exciting collaboration of new people and our veterans. And hopefully the goal is to keep these new people around because we want them in future shows. They are wonderful. We need to keep them.
So you made some reference to the fact that a lot of people, you know, came to those auditions and came to that first rehearsal already knowing this show in terms of loving this show and having deep acquaintance with it. Did you also mean that some of these people came to that first rehearsal, I mean, already knowing all their music? Or is this one of those shows where, I mean, when you love Oklahoma, you probably kind of know all the songs, but is this a show where even if you love the show, that doesn't mean you know it in the way that we sometimes use that term.
I think that's exactly it. We know these themes and these a lot of these words, but like diving into the score is another thing where we discovered things like, well, Sondheim really is going up melodically here instead of what someone might have done on an original Broadway cast recording, or what's notated in the script is not what we, or the score is not what we exactly want to do. So we really tried to be faithful as much as we could to the score. Make sure you take that breath there. Make sure you crescendo here and bring this beauty out. Let's make sure all these chords align beautifully. So there was a lot of digging in on everybody's part.
I'm just curious what your first rehearsal was like. That is your first musical rehearsal. I mean, where does one begin when you're undertaking a score of this sort of complexity and intricacy?
Yeah, we actually started with the finale. We broke down that little bit of Into the Woods at the end where we're in three separate groupings, which really helped. It helped people kind of get to know each other or become acquainted with the group that they would be with, and also to start hearing those themes because they pop up multiple times throughout the whole show. It just those motifs just keep going and going throughout the whole production. So to start there as a base, I thought was a good spot because we could build upon it. It was a good building block.
Absolutely. Talk about the technical challenges that are part of this show. I mean, in terms of the theater side of things and the staging of this, what kind of challenges does it present?
Yeah, so on the theater side, like obviously costumes could be a nightmare because we're talking about high fantasy. We have Rapunzel with her 10-foot plus long wig, and climbing into a tower is an issue, and we have a cow roaming around the stage and there are just so many fantastical aspects of this show that, like Nick kind of said, like you look at it and you're like, we could do that, and then once you're coming down to it, you're like, we need a cow. We need a tower. It becomes a different aspect entirely. So that also is very fun and freeing for our costume people. Ian Anderson and Katie Koble both did our costumes, and they were able to play and find, and what period are we going to be in, and where, how are we going to make them feel connected? How are Jack's mom and Jack connected? How is little Red and Granny? How do we make them look like they go together? So that was very exciting, I know, for them. And then I was fortunate to have my parents build some of the very cool props. They built a beautiful harp piece, and we rented the cow from a woman in New London. So we're very excited to have that very cool. Our Milky White, I have to brag, is just beautiful. And as such an important part of the show, I'm really happy to say it's a beautiful prop piece we get to use. But additionally, the show itself is very farce-like. What really helped us, though, was that the Theater Guild is built for this show. Because we have eight different entrances, and we can utilize every single entrance in every space. And our scenic designer, Martin McClendon, did a beautiful job of kind of intersecting some of our entrances. So we even had more entrances on top of that where people can come from above and below. And so it keeps the show propelling and moving forward. And if you've ever seen Into the Woods, you know that it could be a very long, it can be a long show, but because everything moves so fluidly at the Racine Theater Guild because of the space, it's farce-like and quick and fast and fun. So that really helped in staging the production.
My understanding is, if I'm not correct, that although the crew is certainly populated by plenty of veterans at the Guild who have done a whole lot of things, you have a few young people who are also part of the crew. And I should think this is a whale of an experience for them to be getting their feet wet on a show like this, of this complexity.
Yeah, we actually have two ASMs who double as ASMs, assistant stage managers, and Snow White and Sleeping Beauty, and then another ASM who are in the grid, and they're flying birds in, and they're tossing leaves, and they're bringing in trees, and they're bringing in houses, and they're wheeling out lights. And but their energy also is what we need in our theater because they're excited. They cannot wait to. I keep telling them, you're the hidden heroes of the show. You're the magic. You're putting the magic in the woods for us. So that kind of energy has been so uplifting and fun to have in the cast and crew aspect as well.
Nick Cicerelli, you mentioned the fact that because you are both the narrator and then this mysterious old man who appears not until the second act, right?
No, I'm throughout the first act as well. I switched.
Oh, really?
It switches almost from page to page in some instances.
I'd forgotten that it happens all the way through the show. So tell us a little bit about these sometimes incredibly rapid costume changes that you have to make.
Oh, and, my goodness.
And what it's like to be the person being changed, so to speak.
So I have a team, literally a team of people who I meet off stage, and they're on top of every single moment, every single scene I come off. But my second costume just kind of layers on top of my first costume, and so I step off stage, and it's about three or four people, depending on which day, and they just throw things on top of me. And they have it down to an order, and they have it down to a science, and there's one change in particular that is very grueling. I think we timed it out to 15 seconds. That is astonishingly fast, and they're there waiting for me, and thank goodness they are, because I could not do it on my own without them.
It's kind of amazing that a show would be created that has costume changes like that. I mean, you kind of wonder, like, what was Stephen Sondheim thinking to have that be part of it? Maybe it was unavoidable.
I'm not certain. I'm not certain. I always think that, too, when a playwright writes a quick change like that or expects a character to make some giant costume change at the turn of a page, and I'm not certain. Hmm. It's interesting to see, and I think the audience even takes into amazement how quickly that happens, and I think that there's something spectacular about even something as simple as a costume change, how quickly that transformation is made. And that happens, it's not only to me as well. There's other characters who go through some changes that are very fast. And I think that's part of that magic element, almost, that you experience with all the other stuff.
Nick Ciccarelli was the narrator, and Rob Cruz served as both stage and music director of the Racine Theatre Guild's remarkable production of Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods. You're listening to Morning Show Saturday on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. A couple of weeks after that memorable conversation, we had a conversation about opera. Specifically, the Kenosha Opera Festival and their production of Rossini's great comedy, The Barber of Seville. It was great to have in our studios not just Nick Huff, the artistic director and creator of the Kenosha Opera Festival, now in its second season, but also two of the talented young singers who were brought to town to head the cast for Barber of Seville, mezzo-soprano Edith Grossman and baritone Hee Sung Che. I asked both of them to talk about how they were exposed to the wonderful world of opera.
Yeah, so I'm originally from Buffalo, New York, actually the suburbs of Buffalo, New York, a little town called Elma. Hmm. And there's a really, really great musical theater, regional theater scene in Buffalo. So coming out of high school, I was very fortunate enough that our high school drama director also worked in the Buffalo musical theater scene. So I got into that musical theater scene right out of high school and thought, maybe I'll do musical theater. I really love the music of it. And I'd been taking classical voice lessons, so I had been introduced to opera, but I hadn't decided that it was the career for me yet. And I explored more of the classical musical theater realm, Carousel, My Fair Lady, some Cole Porter, Kiss Me, Kate. And then when I got to college, I was introduced more to the full scale of opera. So we had a scenes program that we did along with a full production in the spring. And so I was introduced to the full orchestration of opera. And that was my magic moment of, whoa, this is awesome. And this is what I want to do.
In other words, hearing orchestra doing opera, singing opera with orchestra in the background versus piano or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, in musical theater, you of course have the microphone that you sing with, and there's often a lot of synthesizers, which is wonderful in itself. Like the musical Six uses a full like rock band, which is very exciting. But something about the orchestration in opera and the voice intermingling like through like natural acoustics, because there are no microphones used, of course. There's something really wonderful and magical when the voice and the orchestra are both leading the story, and then sometimes it's the voice leading the story, sometimes it's the orchestra, and they each react and kind of work as almost a character together, and I really loved that. So that was my magic moment to decide to go into opera. Yeah, so I did my undergrad at SUNY Potsdam in New York, and then kind of jumped into the young artist scene, did some summer programs. Nick and I met at Marilla in 2019. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just kind of been freelancing since.
Fantastic. So you were in the Jake Heggie opera together?
Yes.
Yes. What was the name of your role in that?
I was Rachel. She was this lovely, lovely individual.
You had a great fight scene, though.
She had a great fight and death scene. It's one of those roles where you get this wonderful scene and then you're out by intermission. So
there you go. But how exciting. And so that's where your connection was made then with Nick.
Yeah.
And this invitation then to come and be part of the Kenosha Opera Festival.
Yeah.
Very good. Sitting right next to you in our studios is the baritone who is performing the role of Figaro in The Barber of Seville, Hee Sung Che. And I understand you hail originally from South Korea. Is that right?
Yeah, South Korea. I was born in like Busan, which is really southern part of Korea. Yeah, but I didn't live that much in Busan, and then I moved to nearby Seoul, and then I went to college in Seoul, and then I did master in Seoul, and then I came to U.S. for studying opera more.
Mm. Right.
Yeah.
So tell us about when you were first introduced to opera. I mean, how did you first come to even hear it?
And I mean, my mom loved music a lot, like, when I was young, so like my sister also like plays violin, and like we were like musician family also. Mm-hmm. And when I was young, I did like boy soprano with like in the chorus and like everything that kind of stuff. And then I got voice transformed.
Mm-hmm.
So like I stopped singing and I was like just studying and like drawing.
Oh,
yeah, I was good thrower. Yeah. And then like in the middle school, like my voice got pretty settled, and my mom suggested me to try opera singing. So I just like checked with like professional opera singer, and then he said, oh, you have a talent.
Hmm.
So I just started.
So your mom heard something in your voice where she thought opera would be good for
yeah,
you?
Yeah, because when I start like chorus thing when I was really young, like I was she has lots of LPs.
Mm.
So like she had lots of like tenors LP and baritones LP, and she used to like play a lot in our house. So I was always like mimicking them.
Ah.
Like even though I don't know the words and meaning, and I was just like following just recording, and she was so proud of it. And like when her friends comes to our house, like she always asked me to sing that.
Wow.
So I used to do that a lot.
Wow.
Yeah, that's why I feel like my mom like think that I have a talent with singing.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So when you went to college, then you were studying music and studying singing specifically?
Yeah, I get it. I majored in voice department. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah. and singing mostly opera at that point?
Yeah, I always seeking for opera. I mean, some people just go to the like pedagogy way, like some people go to like other way, but like I always like looking for like singing and performing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very good. And I'm assuming, are we talking about what we think of here as opera? Because I know that, for instance, in China, when you talk about opera, you're talking about a very different kind of opera that's based in China.
Yeah.
Does Korea have its own operatic tradition, or were you mostly singing Mozart and Rossini and so on?
I mostly sing like Mozart and like Gounod and Rossini and like Italian and French, that kind of stuff. But like in Korea, we do have our own opera, but like not that popular.
Mm.
Yeah, but in concert, like we sing lots of like Korean songs, which is beautiful.
Ah, very good.
Uh-huh.
Just tell us a bit about the decision that you and I assume your parents made for you to ultimately come to the United States to continue studying. Tell us about that decision to make that big move. And was that a kind of a scary move to make?
Actually, no. My mother's family all lives in Portland, Oregon. So, like, we visit a lot when I was young. So my ear was pretty open, but I couldn't speak well, just like now.
You're doing great. You're doing great.
Yeah. You're doing great. But I'm pretty, like, familiar with, like, American culture things and English. And so, like, my mom invited from my aunt to get a green card. So I have a green card when I was young. So I keep that green card even though I was in Korean college. Yeah, and then I think my mom planned everything.
Sounds like she had a master plan and it's because, worked out
because
well.
Because I love to sing always. Mm-hmm. Like, she knows that.
Yeah. Right. She maybe knew it better than you knew for a while.
Maybe.
Baritone Hee Sung Che and mezzo-soprano Edith Grossman headed up the cast of the Kenosha Opera Festival's production of Rossini's The Barber of Seville, four performances presented with orchestral accompaniment at the Rody Center for the Arts in downtown Kenosha. This was the second season for the Kenosha Opera Festival under the direction of Nick Huff. To finish out this edition of Morning Show Saturday, I want to play for you a brief excerpt from my memorable conversation this past Thursday with Brian Albrecht, president of Gateway Technical College, who has recently announced his retirement. This was almost certainly his last Morning Show appearance. President Albrecht has been a monthly visitor to the program throughout his 16-year tenure as president. By his calculation, he has been a Morning Show guest nearly 200 times during that period. Brian Albrecht actually came to Gateway 19 years ago to be a special assistant to then-President Sam Borden. Shortly thereafter, President Borden announced his retirement, and ultimately, Brian Albrecht was selected to be his successor. I'm just curious, was it with any trepidation? I can't imagine there wasn't at least a little bit of trepidation in terms of stepping into a position like that. But obviously something about where you were at and where Gateway was at that point in time, it felt like something you should go after.
Yeah, I think probably the experiences. So as an example, part of my role at the Department of Public Instruction was to oversee student organizations. So I'll just use one example, SkillsUSA. Well, Snap-on had been a very strong supporter and still is of SkillsUSA nationally and locally. So they were a partner for me in Kewaunee, where I was a teacher at the Department of Public Instruction. So there was a relationship already that was starting to build for all of this work. But trepidation, no doubt about it. My wife Lisa and our daughter Alyssa stayed back in DeForest, Wisconsin, outside of Madison. So we had two houses going on, one here, one there. I commuted every Tuesday for volleyball games and Tuesdays and Thursdays for track meets. And a lot of Diet Mountain Dew was consumed during that experience. But that was very difficult to do that. But found a place here, of course, and really began to generate the level of engagement. And fortunately, it all worked out great where Alyssa went off to school at Marquette. So this was geographically very close to that effort. Now Alyssa and her husband Anthony and their two boys have homes in Kenosha. So Southeast Wisconsin became a part of definitely who we are. Lisa, as you might know, is a retired principal from West Osha Central. So we have really met a lot of great people and really been able to establish some roots here in Southeast Wisconsin.
Brian Albrecht is the president of Gateway Technical College, but about to begin well-earned retirement, and the search is on for his successor. If you would like to hear this interview in its entirety, or the interviews from which we heard excerpts during this half hour, you're invited to go to WGTD's website, wgtd.org, and there you will find the Morning Show archive. You are also invited to subscribe to the Morning Show podcast, which allows you to hear a different morning show 7 days a week. It's available through all of the major podcast providers, Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast. Just be sure you look for the right name, The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Thank you for listening to Morning Show Saturday. Have a good day.
I'm Steve Brown, inviting you to join me for Education Matters this coming Saturday morning at 10:30. My guest is Kathy Garber, who plays Sissy on Family Affair. Education Matters, 10:30 this coming Saturday morning. From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Root River Council of Racine presents Music in Island Park Saturday, August 27th from 5 until 8. Jazz,